Thank you. And yeah, thank you to the organizers for inviting me. So this is work that I'm doing with Sam Winnick, who's here. He's from the University of Waterloo. And I want to start by talking a little bit about programming languages, quantum programming languages. If you find a quantum programming language these days, you know, something that you can actually write a program on, of course it's going to be based on gates, right? Whether that it's explicitly building circuits or if it's more like some kind of imperative or functional language, you're applying a sequence of gates and building up some algorithm. Maybe there's some classical computing that goes on in between, but the basic fundamentals are gates. And that's because that's what we know how to run on the quantum computers that we have today. But in this talk, I want to poke at the area of going beyond gate-based programming. The idea here being that let's figure out how to identify mathematical abstractions that come from quantum computing and build programming languages or build abstractions that harness those abstractions. And so, you know, the hope is that we'll be able to express algorithms naturally, enable new ideas, and sort of enable new ways of thinking about quantum computing. I'm certainly not the only one to do this, but in this talk I'm going to share one particular idea of these abstractions and sort of walk through what it looks like to develop these ideas as programming languages. So I want to talk about Clifford's. If you're a programmer in a gate-based paradigm, we'll often see Clifford's that are talked about, the ones that are generated by the Clifford gates, X, Y, Z, the Pauli gates, H, S, C naught, et cetera. Of course, mathematically, if you're thinking about the Clifford unitaries, you'll often see the definition as it's the Clifford unitaries are those unitaries that map the Pauli group to itself under conjugation. So the Pauli group, these are not all of the rules of the Pauli group, but the Pauli group generated by X, Y, Z. The Cliffords are the ones that for any Pauli, even any n qubit Pauli, U, P, U dagger is also in the Pauli group. Okay. Put another way, we can talk about just the projective Clifford group as the functions, the automorphisms on the Pauli group. So these are all of the functions that take Paulis to themselves. They're automorphisms, so they're isomorphisms and homomorphisms, and they fix the center of the group. So when I see this definition, I think, okay, so can we write down functions, like as a programmer, can I write down functions on the Pauli group and, know that those correspond to Clifford's? This is, a programming abstraction based on this characterization of Clifford's as automorphisms on the Pauli group. So this is sort of the idea, and now we have to figure out how to turn that idea into a reality. Okay. So let me go through some examples that show what it means to write this sort of function, write this sort of program. So for example, let's say we're trying to write down Hadamard, which is a Clifford, and I want it to be a function from Paulis to Paulis. So here, I'm gonna introduce some syntax. This is, by the way, this is not an actual implementation that I have. This is just an idea of what this syntax would look like. So I'm writing down a function h, and h takes as input one argument p, which has type polytype. And then it returns another polytype. So here, I'm writing polytype for the type of single qubit polyencodings because Hadamard operates on a single qubit. So then we have this case statement, and the idea behind the case syntax is that it breaks up its input, p, here. We can't actually see my text. Okay, so it breaks up the input p here into its basis elements. So one basis of single qubit polys are the x poly and the z poly. And I'm going to use the syntax in x and in z for referring to those primitives. So now we've sort of done a case analysis on our input, and we want to fill in what h takes these polys to. Well, we can do that by looking at the conjugation action of h, right? So Hadamard takes x to z, right? And I'm writing it like this because we're also going to have phases on top of our phases to encode our polys. So, you know, here we need to indicate that it might be plus or minus one. So Hadamard takes x to z with phase zero. And similarly, Hadamard takes z to x with phase zero. So this is sort of how you might fill in this function. Okay. Another simple example is C0, Clifford. And so here, once again, we have a single input p is an input to this function. And now p is a two-qubit poly. So it takes as input something of type polytype plus polytype, right? And now when we do our case statement, we need to break p up into its basis elements. And so its basis elements are either, well, it's either a poly on the first qubit or a poly on the second qubit. And then once we have that q, we can further break that up into x and z. And just like before, we can sort of look at each of these branch cases and see what action does C0 take on this particular basis element, and use that to fill in the each case. So like et cetera, et cetera. And I won't get too hung up on the syntax here, but could sort of fill it in that way. Okay, so hopefully that gives a little idea of what this means to program this kind of function. I want to talk a little bit about what I'm looking for in this programming language. Okay. So, you know, as we said, the main idea is that functions should implement Cliffords. So in particular, I only want a programmer to be able to write down functions that actually do implement these Cliffords, functions that do correspond, that, you know, that are these center-fixing automorphisms on the poly group. So if they were to try to write down something else that does not correspond to one of these center-fixing automorphisms, I would like there to be a type error. So here we have, somebody might write down this function that maps x to x and z to x. So this is not an automorphism. This is not even an isomorphism, right? This is, it's not injective. So I would expect some sort of error when you're writing this down. And there might be some squiggly lines here that indicate type checking error. These two branches, the inX and inZ branches, should anti-commute with each other, but they don't in this case. So this is sort of the crux of the issue here. I want to design a type system for ensuring that these functions that I write down are indeed center fixing automorphisms on the polygroup. Okay. I also want to make sure that all Cliffords can be represented. I don't want to leave any out. And I also want to ideally ensure that these functions can be compiled to circuits. Now I wrote qubit Clifford functions can be compiled to circuits because I'm we'll get to talking about qudits in a little while, but I'm only making this claim about compilation for qubits. But in that case, it's actually pretty straightforward. These functions are very, very closely related to poly tableaus, which I've also called poly frames. Poly tableaus, which are used for both simulation and synthesis of stabilizer circuits. So it's quite straightforward to turn one of these functions, convert it into a poly tableau, and then use some sort of synthesis technique to synthesize a circuit back out. And PCOST is the tool that was developed by my team last year that does that synthesis. So that's all I'm going to say about synthesis for this talk. But okay. So for the rest of this talk, we're going to split this up into three sections to try to break down this problem of how to design a type system for these Cliffords. So I'm going to start by talking about encodings of poly operators. Or sometimes called poly algebras. And then with those encodings, talk about how our projective Cliffords can be represented as symplectic or symplectic form preserving functions over those encodings. And that representation of our projective Cliffords is what we'll use in our type system for symplectic functions. So let's start by talking about the polygroup, right? We sort of saw this before where in this case, the single qubit polys generate the polygroup, which is just exactly these unitaries along with a phase. And the phase is plus or minus one or plus or minus I, right? And the polygroup has lots and lots of nice properties, and it's used in lots and lots of applications, of course. One property of interest is that any two polys either commute or anti-commute, and that's given by the symplectic form, which takes a pair of polys and gives you something in Z2. So this, again, is for qubits. So the commutivity says that P1, P2 is plus or minus 1, P2, P1, and the plus or minus 1 is given by the symplectic form. And we have some, you know, some rules that describe how the polys relate. Now, instead of talking about matrices, I'd really rather talk about something that's not an exponential size matrix, right? If I'm going to be programming with this. So luckily there are very convenient encodings of poly matrices as these algebras where each poly operator can be encoded as just a sequence of bits. And there's several different ways of doing this encoding, but here's the specific one that we're using. So every member of the poly group, again, we're starting with single qubit polys, can be written as I to the R and then delta XZ, where delta XZ is some other, is the product of X to the X and Z to the Z, where X and Z are bits. Along with another coefficient I, depending on the value of x and z. And so, okay, so example, the Y matrix can be written with this phase 0 and then the vector 1, 1. And the reason is, you know, if you work this out, well, Y is equal to IXZ, which is exactly delta 1, 1 is this I to the 1, X to the 1, Z to the 1. And so I'm using this syntax with the angled bracket R and then the square bracket XZ. Now if we you know, one of the nice features of the polyalgebra is that the symplectic form can be computed from it, right? And so you actually just, we don't have to worry about the phase, but the symplectic form on the vectors just takes X1, Z2 minus Z1, X2. And so, you know, if you like, you can work through the example that shows that X and Y, the symplectic form applied to them, gives you 1, which means that they anti-commute with each other, which of course they do. So for the sake of the presentation, this was about single-qubit polys, but of course this completely generalizes to multi-qubit polys. And in that case, we have you know, our representation has the single phase R, which is the exponent of I, and then vectors now, X and Z. And so the vectors, X and Z, are just, you know, sequences of bits, and they indicate the coefficients of the ith, the single qubit poly associated with the ith qubit. The symplectic form is basically defined the exact same way, and I'm going to write V for these vectors in the polyalgebra. So, in other words, V is the set of the X's and Z's, not including R, if that's useful. We can also generalize this polyalgebra in another dimension to refer to Q-dit polys. So the poly matrices X and Z can generalize to Q-dits like in this way, and our polyalgebra does a similar thing. We have our phase, and then we have our vectors X and Z, it's a little bit, we've got a little bit of subtle details here, because this phase R, if you recall in the qubit case, R was in Z4. In this case, we're going to have the phase is an exponent we need a power of D prime. So D prime here is, in the case where D is odd, it's just D. And in the case where D is even, it's 2D. So in the case of qubits, right, we had seen that D was even, so D prime was equal to 4. You know, we have a little bit of complexity here where our phase is in the scope of D prime, and our vectors are in the scope of D. So once we have these encodings, our question was, well, how do we describe the set of projective Cliffords as functions over these encodings? Because these are the things that I'd rather program with these encodings than program with matrices themselves. So the first characterization that we came up with is that the set of projective Cliffords is isomorphic to a set of pairs of functions, delta phi, little delta phi. This is really corresponding to this kind of projective Clifford. So it sends the poly delta V, recall that corresponded to a poly, to delta phi of V with the phase little delta V, right? So we can sort of break our projective Clifford into these two parts that says, you know, first of all, how it acts on what the new vector is, and then what the phase is. And these two functions, delta and phi, have some properties. Well, delta needs to just be a linear transformation, and phi needs to be a symplectomorphism. That is, it's a linear isomorphism that respects the symplectic form. And then this wasn't quite enough. We also need to have an extra condition that says that this function needs to be right definite, needs to be functional. So, I mean, by itself, it's relational, right? If we were to try to come up with a type system for this, this last check was actually something that was quite difficult to enforce, at least in a natural way. So, in addition, there's also this this D prime factor. So, we have to sort of treat the even cases of D differently than the odd cases of D, and these functions are also over V prime, which is also referring to D prime. So we were actually able to go a little bit further and refine this theorem in the following way. So this refinement says that the set of projective Cliffords can actually be characterized as just functions mu psi over our polyalgebra, where everything is only over the dimension d. So we don't have to sort of jump into this d prime case and treat even an odd q-dits differently. Furthermore, we don't have to worry about that last condition that said that the function was right definite, because that's actually just taken care of by this restricted form. So we only have to consider functions over the polyalgebra where mu is a function from V to ZD. It's an R-linear map. And psi is a symplectomorphism from V to V. The trade-off here is that we don't necessarily have this relation anymore. So it's not necessarily corresponding so closely to this map on the deltas, because in order that, so the way that this isomorphism works is that we need to move through our V prime encoding from the previous slide to our compact encoding. So we're calling this the compact encoding, and then move back. So there's a little bit more of a complication when we think about evaluating these functions and what this isomorphism is, but we sort of have this nicer characterization. Okay, so what's the point of me saying all this? With this theorem, we can sort of refine our goal for a programming language. In that now, instead of just saying we need our functions to implement automorphisms on the poly group, we now have something more concrete. We need our functions to implement these pairs, mu xi, where these properties are preserved. And then to know that all Cliffords can be represented, we just need to know that all such functions can be represented. Okay. So, now we have a sort of a more concrete goal, but there's still a question of how to turn this into a type system and how to enforce these properties to hold. So I'm going to do this in three stages. So stage one is defining a type system for free modules over a ring, where our sort of functions are linear transformations. So this is sort of the first step, because both mu and psi have to be linear transformations. All of these sets here, V and ZD, these are modules over the ring ZD. Stage two, is once we've done that, is how do we add constraints that make it so that our functions are all symplectic morphisms? So that's focusing on, you know, restricting ourselves to this psi. How do we ensure that we have a symplectic morphism? And then finally, we'll sort of add the phases back in and combine these two parts, and that will allow us to describe polys as a whole, where we have these two parts. Okay, so how do we go about defining a type system? Well, there are several different components, so let's go through them. So the first thing I want to ask is, what are types? I've been talking about types a lot. What are types? In this case, where I'm defining a type system for modules over a ring, right? My types are going to correspond to free finitely generated R modules. So in other words, I'm going to have a set of module types, and it'll be defined recursively. And the module types will consist of our ring, R, is the base type, and then the direct sum of two module types, so tau 1 plus tau 2. So to start to give meaning to these types, the next question I want to ask is, what are the values of those types? And so the values of the type R are just going to be constants pulled from the ring R. And the values of type tau 1 plus tau 2 are going to be tuples. And I'll write this with these square bracket notation. So pairs of V1, V2, where V1 is a value of type tau 1 and V2 is a value of type tau 2. So next, I want to be clear of what properties I want well-typed expressions to satisfy. And right, we've said this before, that I want this type system to characterize linear transformations over the R modules. And so my expressions, my well-typed expressions here, that is, expressions that maybe have a free variable in them, these expressions should correspond to linear transformations, in that if you substitute in something for the variable, I'm using that notation here, then this should be linear in that substituted in value. And so with all that in mind, now we have to say, okay, well, how do we construct those typing rules to ensure that these expressions are well typed? For the sake of this talk, I'm not going to get too deep into showing the details of the typing rules. But I will show some syntax. So this is the syntax of expressions in our language, where we have variables, we have scalars, R, scalars from the ring, and we have vectors. So these are sort of the values that we talked about in the previous slide. What else can we do with expressions? Well, we can add expressions and we can do scalar multiplication. And then I'm also going to add the syntax for these case expressions, which we saw in the examples before. And so this vector case analysis is sort of saying, well, decompose an expression of type sigma 1 plus sigma 2 into its basis elements. I will say, if you're familiar with linear types, this is a relevant type system in that it allows for contraction, where variables can be duplicated, but not weakening. So all of our variables have to be used. And it's actually quite similar to a line of work by Dowick et al., including Lineal and some newer work since then. In particular, how they also have this byproduct direct sum, although they treat it in slightly different ways. So there's some interesting connections there. I want to say a little bit about the semantics of this language, which by semantics, I mean what do programs in this language do? So there's several different ways to describe, there's several different ways that you can construct a semantics. So one is an operational semantics, where one expression steps to another. So it takes a step. And we use this operational semantics to define an equivalence relation, which says one or two expressions equivalent to each other. This is useful because it's purely syntactic. It's a way to, you know, compare two different expressions for equality or equivalence. We also give denotational semantics or categorical semantics, where every one of these open expressions is going to correspond to a morphism in the category of R modules. That we need to ensure that these two semantics line up. So E corresponds to one morphism, E prime will correspond to another morphism, but the operational semantics and relatedly the equivalence relation ensures that any two equivalent expressions are going to correspond to the same morphism in the category. So not only does this categorical semantics ensure that we really are capturing linear transformations, it also tells us that this equivalence relation is sound. Okay. So I want to quickly talk a little bit about this type system for symplectic morphisms. So again, we're going to ask the same questions. What are our types and what are our values of those types? These symplectic morphisms, well, these are linear transformations, so this is going to be a subset of the language that we just constructed in the previous section. But our types now are restricted because we're only going to consider the free finitely generated R modules for which the symplectic form is defined. And the symplectic form is defined on modules that have even parity. So we can construct them in this inductive way where instead of starting with just R as the base, we start with R plus R. And this R plus R is sort of capturing our single qubit vector encoding, so delta xz. And then we can take the direct sum of two of these symplectic types as well. The property that we want to enforce is that our expressions are all linear transformations that respect the symplectic form. Okay, and by that I mean the symplectic form omega applied to E with V1 substituted for X and E with V2 substituted for X should be the same as omega applied to V1, V2. Our sort of typing judgment looks a little bit different, where we're going to have some variables that are treated linearly. So these are taus, so these are the module types. And then we're going to have one variable that is respects the symplectic form. I know that I'm running low on time, so I'm going to go a little bit quickly through this, but introducing some syntax, we're going to have some syntax that describes the symplectic form, so we can actually write this in our language, omega of E1, E2. I want to talk a little bit about the case rule. So this is a typing judgment in that it's telling us when an expression on the bottom is well-typed, when it has type sigma. And in order for this to be well-typed, all of the judgments on the top are going to have to hold. So we have several judgments on the top, and let's go through them very quickly. So the first statement is that I have an expression E of type Q. I'm using Q to refer to the single Q-dit poly here. So if I have an expression E of a single qubit poly, then how do I break this into pieces? Well, we have one branch for in the case where Q is the basis element X, and then we have one branch in the case where we have the basis element Z. And in order to ensure that this respects the symplectic form, we need to add a check here. And that check says that the symplectic form applied to these two branches is equal to 1. And why is that? Well, it's because the symplectic form applied to these basis elements, X and Z, is equal to 1. And so the symplectic form applied to the branches should also be equal to 1. Okay. And so if we go back to our example, like this Hadamard, for this to be well typed, the type system would need to check that the symplectic form applied to these two branches in Z and in X is equal to 1 in, specifically 1 in Z2 if this is the qubit case. And in fact, if you sort of work out what this is, then it is in fact equal to 1. But if I was to try to write down this non-symplectic function, this check would fail because omega applied to in Z, well, that's equal to 0, which is in fact not 1. Okay. We actually have to treat the case statements for single q-dits and tuples of q-dits differently. So we have a different check for tuples of q-dits, but it's of the same idea. And we're able to actually prove that any such typing judgment does respect the symplectic form in this way. Okay. So I'm almost out of time, so I'll just say that extending this type system to polys, aka combining the linear transformation mu and the symplectomorphism psi, is not too tricky because we set things up in a nice way. We do introduce some syntax, like this bracket, which allows us to add phases, and we saw some examples of that way back in the beginning. We have this this new type phase of sigma, which is corresponding to R plus sigma, in sort of the semantics, in the categorical semantics, where we can recover mu and psi from from this one function, we can recover it into two functions. Okay. So what? So taking a step back, I've proposed this abstraction for programming with functions over polys. Is this really useful? Is this really interesting? I'd say that there's several things in its favor. By allowing us to write functions, we could take advantage of other programming abstractions that we have over functions, like we can use data structures, we can use recursion, we can use polymorphism. We can get interactive feedback when you try to write down a Clifford. So, like as we saw, those little red squiggly lines on the ill-typed functions. That sort of interactive feedback can tell us, maybe help explore what Cliffords are, especially the Q-dit case, wherein they're maybe a little bit less well understood. I hope that this abstraction can help describe, can help express quantum algorithms in terms of like changes of basis, and we can also explore bases for polys other than X and Z. Cliffords themselves we can think of as characterizing a basis for polys. And so there's some, you know, opportunities to explore that as a programming methodology. So one other thing that I'm interested in this question is, you know, how could we extend this beyond just Clifford's? There's other ways in which functions over polys can characterize sets of unitaries, larger sets, and in particular, like the Clifford hierarchy seems like an interesting way of expanding this idea, but we won't get into that. So in conclusion, I think that this is an interesting abstraction, and we've, you know, developed some clever encodings and typing rules that show that this system is sound, and I think that there's some work to be done to show whether it's useful. But hopefully I've demonstrated how type systems can maybe help harness mathematical structures into interesting programming abstractions. So thank you all very much.
Yeah, I guess one question I'm wondering is it kind of, do you see this extending to sort of specifying kind of a family of Clifford maps? Like I can think of like, you know, multi-target CNOT gate, for example, if I want to specify that like, you know, has one control and like a bunch of targets. And are you kind of thinking like some additional language structures that can kind of just specify like family of like n qubit Clifford's?
Yeah, I think that could be one of the you know, direct impacts of being able to program Clifford's in this way is that you can really write sort of meta functions, mm-hmm. if you will, over Clifford. So if they're first class objects, then mm-hmm. you can manipulate them, transform them, and so on. Yeah.
Is there some examples of that in this kind of related work on linear, like in free module types? Or is it kind of...
Sorry, say that again?
So, I mean, you cited several papers that introduce the type systems of free modules. Do they do something like that in that work? Or are they only like kind of limited to first class?
So that work that I cited is some really interesting work where they're focused on writing... these linear transformations over, or unitary transformations really, over quantum states. So rather than writing these over polys like we're doing here, mm-hmm. they're writing these transformations over like over ket syntax, basically. And I'm not sure that they've explicitly developed examples that show what you're thinking of, but I actually have one slide that, not these slides. One extra slide that maybe shows that, that shows an example of doing this. So here's, you know, we know that a poly itself is in fact a Clifford. So we should be able to write a function that takes as input a poly and produces a Clifford, a function, from polys to polys. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you might be able to do that by writing something like this, where it takes as input a Q and returns the Q with just a phase. And so, I don't know if this is exactly what you're thinking, but we're not just doing a case analysis. We're sort of doing something a little bit more abstract and interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, is there any questions online? Or there is a question online, I think.
Yeah. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for your talk. I actually have two quick questions. So the first one is actually about the first type system you gave, just about free modules. So, and you have this expression where you do a case expression. but so the, what you can write there, so you have a fixed basis for a given module, is that right? Or can you use gaze expressions with different...
I'm not quite hearing you. Can you repeat a little bit?
So I was just wondering whether you can... So you have a fixed basis for each type that you have. So you're, when you say your type is a vector, so is a module, so it's a module with a fixed basis, is that correct?
Yes.
So when you do your gaze expressions, you can, so you're only able, I guess in the case of the polys, you're only able to do gaze expressions on the X and Z generators, but not on other, you can choose a different basis for the polys, or could you?
Yeah, if I'm understanding correctly what you're saying, yes, what I've shown is fixing a basis in a particular order, but I think that they're, the design is a little bit tangential to what the basis is, and something that I'm interested in exploring next is how can we sort of flex that basis and maybe choose, you know, users can specify their own bases and use this case notation to break down a basis into an arbitrary basis. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. So I had another question, which actually you touched upon in your last slide. I was going to ask you that, but maybe you can say a bit more about that, which is about going up the Clifford hierarchy, because the same way you can see a Clifford as a map from polys to polys, you could see, say, a third level as a map from poly to Cliffords. Could you use that kind of thing as a way of...
Exactly.
Sort of leveraging these ideas towards a Clifford hierarchy. Maybe you have something you could say more about that.
Exactly. That was my thought as well. The Clifford hierarchy, you know, is sort of generic in that it always maps polys to the next level or to the previous level of the Clifford hierarchy. And so, well, can we, you know, characterize these as these symplectic preserving functions in this recursive way? And so far, we haven't worked out the details of, you know, these functions over the encodings like we saw and how would those translate to this level of the Clifford hierarchy, and how can we preserve these properties in the more generic case? But I think it's really promising, and I think I really hope that this works out, because that would be a really interesting way of exploring the Clifford hierarchy. So, yeah.
Maybe just as a pointer, because I think it's more than that. It is a function from the polys to the Clifford. Is that any function from polys to Clifford that respects the commutation relation will be a third level Clifford, and this sort of holds as you go up the hierarchy. So there is some sort of characterization. I think probably Nadish's talk will touch upon that. So maybe just as a pointer, it might be good to see whether you can use any of those ideas from that. I think that's tomorrow, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really sorry. I didn't quite catch all that, but. Right. Maybe we could take it offline. I'd be really interested in discussing it.
Sure. I think, yes, sure. Thank you, yeah.
All right, first, so. And thank you, Jennifer.